Yakuza. Yakuza. Yakuza Kick Radio.
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 The Yakuza Kick Radio.
This is the Bulldozer, Matt Tremont. And if there's one place to listen to on the internet, every Thursday, 9 p.m., Yakuza Kick Radio. Tremont says so. Who wants some?
God help us, Jesus! God and baby, Jesus! Help us.
Ladies and gentlemen of fucking America, this is Danny Havoc, and you have been listening to, or possibly are intending to listen to, the Yakuza Kick fucking radio. Fucking, yeah! Yakuza Kick radio.
Hell fucking yeah!
My name is Justice Payne, and you are listening to Yakuza Kick Radio.
You're coming to come on Thursday night in
This is a brotherhood, and we all stick together. Like my nuts.
I ain't scared of you, motherfucker.
Yakuza Kick Radio, the best in internet wrestling radio, period, bar none, just like Adam Cole.
Everybody's a cunt but me in the world. I don't know what it is.
But you go to the back, and you tell your boss that there's a new Yakuza in town. And Yakuza Kick Radio, and we're taking over.
Yakuza Kick Radio has risen from the ashes of bad internet radio and become the premier place for any independent professional wrestler to stop and record their voice.
The shit is bananas.
Well, this is Mr. Insanity, Toby Klein, and if you're not listening to Yakuza Kick Radio, then you're weird.
Oh, I don't like the cut of your jib, fella.
This is Greg Excellent, Bearded Dragon of the Northeast. You're listening to Yakuza Kick Radio. If you're not, probably watching porn and you have this muted. You should be listening to it, Jason Mann.
Where are Biggie and Tupac?
Yakuza Kick Radio.
Give a nigga rope one of their cowboy guys.
All you have to do is listen to Yakuza Kick Radio, but you didn't. Now look at that doctor, homie. Fuck that. Black D.
Bullshit, man. Motherfucker.
Fuck you. Fuck you and fuck you. Who's next?
And now, ladies and gentlemen, for the introduction.
Hosted by J-Cat Morris.
You are now listening to
Yakuza Kick Radio.
It is Friday, October 30th, 2015. Welcome to Yakuza Kick Radio. I'm your host, J-Cat Morris. And I'm doing this show so I can get this this interview in. And my guest tonight is Deathmatch legend, Madman Pondo. What's going on, man? Ah, that's fucking blog talk. He's got the little wheel spinning in the circle when I said to put the thing on. So, of course, there's always an issue. There you go. You there, man?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I got you, man.
All right. Well, I apologize about last time. Go ahead and start them over this time. Maybe I'll even answer different. Who knows?
All right, man. No worries. So, yeah, man, you've been doing this a long, long time. When did you actually get started in wrestling?
My very first match was June 24th, 1989, in Albion, Illinois. And I paid to train, so I trained the whole 6 months. They wanted me to start sooner than the 6 months, but I trained for 6 months and then wrestled. He was called the Avalanche, and then at USWA he was called Melvin Pinrod Jr., but that was my first match.
What was training like back then? You know, what did it involve? And, you know, things must have changed a lot over the years, but.
Well, back then, there was guys who wanted to make sure that you wanted to stay in this business. Me and my friend, Leslie Slick Thompson, we went in as a tag team. And these guys more or less were just brutalizing us and kicking our faces in and pulling our hair and blacking our eyes and stuff. And, you know, wrestling's, I knew that this is what I wanted to be. I wanted to be a professional wrestler, so I stuck with it and stayed in there. But my best friend said, man, I'm not just going to pay these guys just to kick my shit in. So he quit, but I kept going. And am today.
Yeah. So what were your inspirations to actually get into wrestling and do it?
Back in the day, I mean, way back in the day, my family's pretty reserved, and they don't really, you know, cuss or, you know, totally different from me. So my great-grandma and great-grandpa, they'd be watching Jerry King Lawler's CWA, which became USWA later, but they would be yelling out things like, you know, dirty motherfucker and stuff like that. Well, me and my brother was just in awe, you know, and for some reason that was so cool and so funny to me, it made me a fan. So, you know, I was going to a lot of wrestling growing up. My grandma would take me to some. A guy named Roy West would take me to a bunch. And, you know, I would see wrestling at the Chase in St. Louis, Angelo Papa's ICW around the Illinois area. Was going to Jerry King Lawler's USWA. And then Chicago, we would go to AWA and WCW and WWF at the time. But my favorite company in Chicago was a place called Windy City Wrestling, because they would do things like Sergeant Slaughter took on Abdullah the Butcher.
Mm-hmm.
Bruiser Brody took on John Nord. Terry Gordy took on Bam Bam Bigelow for the Bam Bam name, you know, just really cool stuff like that. I was more into that than I was all the other stuff. But just growing up, man, just going to wrestling is just, you know, made me always want to be one. My mom still has a piece of paper somewhere from school. It says, draw a picture of what you want to be when you grow up. And, you know, kids were drawing policemen and firemen, and kiss-ass kids was drawing teachers, but mine's got a wrestling ring with two stick people wrestling each other. So I knew what I wanted to be.
Nice. So, you know, where did you decide, like, what kind of style of wrestling you wanted to work? Obviously, you know, you went down the deathmatch road. You know, what made you decide to go down that road and take it as far as you've taken it?
I was only weighing in at about 165 pounds, and nobody was really taking anything that I was doing all that serious. You know, I was with guys that were pretty basic, so they was training me to be basic, but I didn't want to be basic. I wanted to be something more. So I started traveling all these places. I mean, Nevada, South Dakota, you know, any place that would say yes, I would go wrestle for them, but you know, nothing was really helping me get my name out there. And then I started doing the tape trading thing and got a hold of Puerto Rico and Japanese videotapes. And, of course, there was just madness, just craziness going on these tapes. And that's what really got me going. So that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be a deathmatch wrestler.
Yeah. How'd you come up with your name and your gimmick?
Going to wrestling, all the crazy guys is really who I like. I like the Abdullah the Butchers. I like the sheep herders, not the bushwhackers, but the sheep herders, not that retarded shit they started doing later. And Bruiser Brody and, you know, just the really crazy guys. So that's what I wanted my name to be. I wanted to have something crazy in it, but there was a Maniac Mark Lewin, Crazy Mike Miller, you know, the only name like that that wasn't taken was Madman. So I went ahead and held on to the Madman name. Then there was a movie called The Party Animal that has a guy on there named Pondo that was a seven-year college student that had a lot of trouble getting laid. Well, in high school, that was my nickname, Pondo. So I just put them together, Madman Pondo, and it took me a while to get that name out there. If it wasn't Madman, it was always Mad Dog. If it wasn't Pondo, it was always Poncho or Pongo. But finally, after a while, Madman Pondo started sticking in people's heads. So that's how I got the name.
The stop sign's a big part of your arsenal, pretty much your go-to. How did that become your deal and your weapon of choice?
I was in Central City, Kentucky, and two small children, I mean children, like 8 or 9 years old, started hitting each other, you know, called me over and said, Pondo, watch this, and started trading the shots with each other with trash can lids. And here I've been knocking grown men out with my trash can lid. So I got to thinking, I got to come up with something that's about the same size, that's harder to get a hold of, that still will make a noise and will not freak people out. And pretty much that's what the stop sign came. There was in Central City, they had it was a old flea market, so there was a whole bunch of stuff laying in the back, and one of them was a stop sign, so I started using that. A lot of guys back then didn't really like the idea of getting hit by a stop sign, but, you know, after a while, it just started kicking in, and that's what I started using.
You know, that's definitely a unique thing that a lot of people don't have included in their gear bag and stuff. So, you know, how has it been traveling with that type of thing or getting one over the years?
I'll tell you a story. One time I got pulled over, and people had given me a whole bunch. I probably had 10 or 12 stop signs, a little stacked, sitting in my trunk. And back in the day, the police officer would make you get out of your car and go sit in his front seat to sign a ticket. So I started walking back to his car with them. And he said, hey, buddy, you got something hanging out of your trunk. And it was my handle on my gear bag. So I opened the trunk, lifted it, put that piece in there, and as I was trying to slam it, he put his hand in between the trunk and picked it back up, and there was that stack of stop signs. And he said, I don't know if you remember this or not, but in Georgia, this was right around that time, in Georgia, some teenage kids had took the stop sign down from a four-way stop, and two cars hit each other and killed a young child, a young baby. That was right around this time. So, you know, he was really on me about this stack of stop signs, and he counts them all. He goes back to his car and grabs a calculator and comes back to me and says, Mr. Candy, do you realize you have $500,000? Worth of fines in your car right now? And I just started flipping, like, look, fans gave me these, I didn't steal them. But he looks down and he goes, all right, I'm going to go with your story about the stop sign. He picked up this barbed wire bat that had my hair all in it and there was blood all in it. But he said, you want to tell me what this is? And I said, well, I like to hunt animals, but I like to give them a fair shake. But he didn't find any comedy in that at all. But he gave me a $500 fine, and I had to go back. Let's see, what was it? I think Spencer, Indiana. I had to go back to Spencer, Indiana to go to court about these stop signs. But, yeah, that was about my only problem I've had. I've never stolen one. That way I can pass a lie detector test someday if I have to. But fans give them to me all the time. I've traveled with them to Japan and Australia and England, Germany, Mexico, any place I've went. I've taped two pieces of cardboard together with a stop sign in the center of them and traveled with them. So stop sign's been all right with me. And sometimes it's aggravating. I wish I would have found something smaller, but I didn't. So
I mean, the first time I got to see you was in CZW. I started going CZW February 2001, and, you know, then afterwards I got some tapes and stuff and started seeing, you know, the back stuff that you were doing there, and, you know, from there I caught on to IWA and all that stuff. But the first thing I saw of you, you know, well, the earliest thing I saw of you, I should say, was the Bloodbath 2000, and it was you and Ian and a pair of scissors and some of the deepest cuts I've ever seen in a wrestling ring. I had that whole thing go down.
The thing with that was me and Ian, we wanted to get a job at CZW. And the ECW hat guy was out in the crowd. Remember the ECW hat guy?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
yeah.
me and Ian told each other, you know, if we could get a reaction out of that guy, we can get a job anywhere. So we asked everybody in the locker room, does anybody have a pair of scissors? And Lord Everett Hayes brought us a pair of scissors. We didn't know that he hurried up and got them out of the straight out of the package, so they were still razor sharp. And we got in front of the hat guy, sure enough. I ran it across Ian's forehead, but he had his back to me, so I didn't know how deep the gash was. You saw on the tape, it was pretty deep. And then
he gave me
one on the arm and, you know, 20 stitches across his head and 11 in my arm. We pretty well got jobs at CZW. I did. They kept me. They didn't keep me, and I don't know why. But he started working for them a long time after I was there for a little stint there with the invasion thing. But
right.
You know, but what a thing to be famous for, you know, scissors.
Yeah. Now, you had a match in Delaware that was the main event of Uneffing Believable, and, you know, a lot of people remember Uneffing Believable, and it's the, you know, the June Desai match and Nick Mondo and Payne and Cashmere. You guys actually went on after that match, and a lot of people actually forgot about it. No rope, barbed wire, and everything, which is usually a very well-remembered match. You know, what was it like following that?
I remember how long the night was of professional wrestling before it got to Johnny Cashmere, Trent, and Kasai and Mondo. And then even after their match, there was a long promo afterwards. Do you remember June Kasai bled like water mm-hmm. out of his back? Well, that had to be mopped up in a few spots, and the barbed wire still had to be put up. So, you know, a lot of people had already left, as far as I remember. But it was hard getting them going because, you know, everybody was tired. It was long, long hours. But I do remember by the end of the match that me and Lobo had them pretty good. And I've still got one on my chest where one of the barbs went inside my skin, and I saw Lobo coming, so I had to pull it out real quick. But as far as I remember, by the time we was done, everybody was on their feet having a good time, so I guess we did what we were supposed to do.
Yeah. You know, what was your, you know, how do you remember the your relationship with Zandig, and how was it, you know, working with Zandig?
Zandig is stuck in his ways, and you know, that's not a bad thing. If you think about it, CZW wouldn't have the name that it does today if it wasn't for John Zandig. DJ Hyde bought what John Zandig made and created, so CZW still lives, but to be born was John Zandig. And, you know, he had a knack for finding unusual wrestlers that, you know, would mutilate their bodies for the entertainment of others. And then later, more started coming to him and saying, hey, can I work for you? And from 2000 to 2002 or 3, the end of 2 or the beginning of 3, you know, we was flying back and forth to Japan a lot. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, there was ups and downs there, but, you know, I got no problem with nobody. So there in Philly, John Zandig gave me an opportunity to wrestle in front of the Philly crowd. And in my opinion, if you can make it as a wrestler in Philly, you can make it anywhere. So, you know, I got no problem with John Zandig at all, and I don't think he has a problem with me as well. Actually, I was watching his shoot interview that he did for Smart Mark, and
mm-hmm.
and every name they would mention, John would be like, ah, that guy sucks, that guy's a piece of shit. And then they said my name, and I was waiting on it, but John Daly was like, oh, he's a nice guy. So, you know.
So, you know, like you said, I mean, he had a knack of finding a lot of guys that would do this type of thing. And, you know, some of those guys, their careers weren't so, you know, long-lived. But you got a chance to work with a lot of these guys that are legends, like the Wife Beater. What was your thoughts on working the Wife Beater?
Well, me and Matt is one of the funniest guys that I've, Wife Beater is one of the funniest guys in person that I've ever talked to, so... We always had a real good time, and I always got a lot of shit from deathmatch fans, you know, that they always said that, well, Pondo was not as good as this guy. But here's the problem. When I started doing deathmatches, there was no social media, you know, it was just
right. All
videotapes in a Kmart building in Louisville, Kentucky, so it just... took a while for death matches to become popular like they was. Well, by then, I'd already, you know, got power bombed into a big screen TV and you know, power bombed through all these light tube log cabins. But, you know, without that social media, like what was getting popular when CZW started getting popular, you know, people always come to me, well, not come to me, but I always read on the internet or people say, Pondo was never as good as this guy. Well, back when I was doing it, there was no, you know, there was, Ian and Axel started doing it at ECW, and then they left ECW, and then I got with Ian when Axel was against death matches. So I would say that me, Axel, Ian, and Bull Payne was the four guys that, you know, I mean, I was doing it every Tuesday in front of 300 to 400 fans in Louisville, but they just kicked my shit in, you know, so I would say that I was, and I, you know, I never put myself over, but I'd say I was one of the pioneers of deathmatch wrestling in America, and then, you know, people just started following along afterwards. I remember that me and Ian did the truck stop match in New Jersey in front of John Zandig, who was shaking his head at us, looking at us like we was a couple of retards. but later on, John Zandig started doing death matches himself. So, you know, it just took a while for death matches to evolve. And then when they did, man, people started coming from everywhere to watch them and do them and all types of stuff.
Lobo, you know, a lot of the newer fans might not know Lobo, but, you know, he was kind of like CZW's Mick Foley. I mean, this guy would take bumps off of anything. And, you know, what was your thoughts on Lobo?
I always wanted to wrestle Lobo more. I only got to wrestle him once, but, when I saw him come out of that roof, you know, that just awed me. I remember Lobo took a bump off a balcony through flaming barbed wire boards and just laid there in the board. Like security had to grab him and pull him out of there, you know. I mean, I always liked the brave deathmatch guys, and that was the epitome of Lobo. He was not only a deathmatch guy, but he was very brave about it.
Yeah, sure. And then, you know, another guy with the similar name, Nick Mondo.
Mondo, for his size, was probably one of the bravest guys. You know, I mean, I used to do a lot of stupid shit, but I don't know if I would let somebody weed eat the skin off my stomach. You know, I mean, he had the same skills I did, but he also had high-flying skills, which made him double impressive in the deathmatch world. You know, that bunch that him and Homeless Jimmy took off that truck.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's classic, man. I mean, but it just took a guy who had high-flying skills and deathmatch skills to pull that off. And you know, and me and Nick Mondo hung out in Japan a lot. Me and Nick Mondo and Trent would just walk around these country towns, you know, and we all became pretty good friends. So, yeah, I got a lot of respect for Nick Mondo.
Yeah. Later on in CZW, they brought you in for a tournament of death, and I think it was a match against Toby Klein, and you took a spot with sharpened pencils. what do you remember about that?
I remember sitting back. It was at a motorcycle track,
yeah,
I believe, and I remember sitting back and watching people. Not people, but the people on the show would walk over to the backstage where all these weapons was laid out like a MASH unit. And, you know, a lot of them was pointing at this and saying, I'll do this, I'll do this. But everybody would look at that bed of pencils and be like, I'm not going to fuck with that. So then Necro Butcher and Brain Damage was going over their match. And I saw Necro go over who Necro to me is a guy who never said no to anything. You know,
right.
I saw him look at that bed of pencils and go, no, we're not doing that. And I was like, holy shit, that's what I'm going to do. So, because I knew that I was out in the first at Tournament of Death, but I wanted to do something that was remembered at that Tournament of Death. And three things I've heard over and over about that same Tournament of Death. That guy, I can't remember his name, Blood something, that
Blood
went into that, went over that top rope into that shopping cart and cut his knee so deep.
Mm-hmm.
And then Nick Gage got caught on fire. And the third thing that I hear about that Tournament of Death over and over again is about that bed of pencils. So I'd say that I did what I needed to do to be remembered in that one.
Mm-hmm. How do you work out on, like, how you're going to take that, or, you know, everyone else didn't want to take it at all. And, I mean, you took it to the, I think, like a DVD or something like that.
Yep, I took a Death Valley Driver, and I knew by taking that Death Valley Driver that there was going to be no backing out once I got on Toby Klein's shoulders. So that's what I said I was going to do. I said, you know, because that was Toby Klein would do a spinning Death Valley Driver. So I told Toby, let's do that. Toby started arguing with me. He didn't want me to take a Death Valley Driver on it. And I was like, no, this is what we're going to do. And Toby even took scissors and started cutting the tops off of them. And I told him, I said, Toby, it's not going to do no good. Just leave those tops on there. No problem. So I did, and that was 6 days of agonizing body pains that I've had in my whole life. I still have the marks in my back where pencils went all through. I've got a big purple mark going all the way down into my crack where one got me in the ass real hard. I got them on the back of my arms. But, like I said, I wanted to do something to be remembered at that Tournament of Death, and that's what I did.
Yeah. So now, you know, I started with CZW, and obviously before that, you know, you're in IWA Mid-South. How did you get hooked up with Ian and, you know, start into IWA Mid-South?
I heard that Ian had broke away from ECW. Now, if you talk to him, he quit. If you talk to others, he got fired. Doesn't matter to me. But I lived in a small town of Florida, Illinois. And when I heard that Ian was no longer with ECW, I started calling every wrestler that I knew. And I finally got a hold of one that knew how to get a hold of Ian Rotten. So I called Ian Rotten on the phone, told him my name, and I said, death matches is what I want to do. You know, I would like to wrestle you wherever I could. Well, nobody had heard of me, you know. I was just a small-town kid doing small-town wrestling shows, and he had never heard of me. But finally, I talked the guy into booking me and Ian. And the night before the show, that guy backed out and said, I'm not going to be able to give Ian what I said I was going to. So I gave it to him. And it was under the understanding that whole time that the first match was going to be a barbed wire baseball bat. Because let's face it, when that breed turned on each other, that barbed wire baseball bat, that was fresh and amazing. Like, everybody was like, oh, my God, you know. So
right.
That's what I wanted to do. But when Ian showed up, he had only brought a leather strap. So he explained to me, he's like, I don't know you, you don't know me, I don't want to hurt each other. So our first match we're going to do, we'll just do, you know, this leather strap, which was attached to our wrists. I said, mm-hmm. No problem. So anytime Ian would hit me with that strap, I would make sure that I was bleeding in that spot, you know. And I did it so much that I made Ian Rotten look at me and go, God damn it, kid, stop gigging. All right. So after that, we sat down. He goes, all right, you showed me. He's like, we'll do barbed wire bat next time. So that's somebody from that company booked us in almost the same area, but different company. We did barbed wire bat. I took everything the way I was supposed to. And then, you know, me and Ian just started going on the road to all these places, to Detroit, to Carluzzo's NWA and Philly. And, you know, we just, the blood trail everywhere we went. And that turned into Ian was going to run IWA out of this Kmart building. Well, for the first two and a half months, me and Ian was the main event, doing just ungodly, crazy things to each other. And that's more or less how I got started at IWA, Mid-South.
Yeah. So, you know, then he comes with the King of the Death match. And, you know, from what I know, I mean, it's pretty much the first death match tournament in the U.S. You know, what was your thoughts going into that?
There was a guy named Tim Jackson running out of Evansville, Indiana. And he was doing death matches with guys named the Rough Riders, me and another guy named Ox Harley. But we was getting real good crowds at this building called the Evansville Coliseum with these death matches. So it was my idea to Tim Jackson. I was like, look, what we need to do is we need to get eight guys and we need to do this thing called King of the Death Matches. Because, like I said, I was a tape trader, so I had the Mick Foley, Terry Funk death match. And, you know, we even tried to book Ian for it, and Ian wasn't about it. He was like, no, you know, I don't want to go down there and do it. Well, Tim Jackson dropped the ball, and next thing I know, Ian Rotten started doing King of the Death Matches. You know, he called me and Ox and said, hey, do you guys want to do mine? Which is cool, you know. I mean, I know that that's where the idea came from, but it's all cool, whatever. But, you know, I wrestled Tower of Doom in barbed wire boards, and then I wrestled Doug Gilbert, who suplexed me off the edge of the ring into a circus thing of barbed wire. But, you know, but I was part of the first King of the Death matches here in America, so I was pretty happy about it.
Yeah. So, you know, then you're there a while. Go forward to King of the Death Match 03, which is still revered as one of the best King of the Death Match tournaments that's ever happened. And you go to the finals against J.C. Bailey, who is a pretty young guy in the business at the time. And, you know, what was your thoughts on that whole tournament?
I got to wrestle Nick Gage. I think, didn't I wrestle Nate Webb the first night?
I think so.
Yeah, I believe so. You know, it was just an honor to me that, you know, that I was a big enough deathmatch star that I was put over in this 2003 King of the Death Matches. And just later on, people kept saying, the best King of the Death match was 2003. You know, I've heard that several times, which makes me very happy since, you know, that was my King of the Death match year. So, but,
right. But
even you saying that even confirms, you know, that a lot of people say that 2003 was the best King of the Death match year.
Right. Now, you know, going into the finals with JC, you guys used the spot with a taser on the steel cage. How'd you come up with that spot?
Actually, that one came off the fly. JC had climbed to the top of the cage, and I was supposed to get up there to do something, and I don't even remember what that was. But we didn't anticipate that these light tubes hanging down from the top of the cage was going to get in the way as much as they did. So when he climbed up at the top of the cage, whatever I was supposed to do, I wasn't there for it. So that's when I took the taser and put it on the cage, and that's when JC took his bump off of it. But it's crazy. I don't even remember what I was supposed to be doing, but I know that I wasn't there for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another big, big match you had with JC is legendary match of the Circus Death Match. And, how did that come about that you guys were going to do that? I think they've done them in Japan, but first in the States. And
that's where I got that from Masanaga. But, you know, Masanaga had a small scaffold across the ring, and then two guys came at each other. And I always pictured, you know, that I wanted to do that better than those guys. So I started thinking of ways to make it better, and I'm the one who decided to do three tiers. That way we could do one small bump off the bottom, a little higher one off the middle, and then the big one off the top. But, when I came to JC and said, hey, would you do this match with me? JC was just a bigger fan of Japanese wrestling as I was. He was like, hell yeah, I will. And our only condition was that it made it on videotape, and it did. So, you know, the sad thing about it is this happened maybe 1 or 2 weeks ago. Somebody put a clip, you know, from the finish, and all the comments underneath there was, this is dumb, you know, this isn't wrestling, all this shit. Well, for two guys who was a fan of Japanese wrestling, that was wrestling, that was our wrestling, and, you know, I don't feel bad about doing it at all, so all those guys' comments can go fuck themselves.
Right. Now, you know, the way the match went down, obviously, the stipulation kind of limits you as far as, you know, what kind of wrestling or what kind of things you could do, because, you know, the ring is more or less tarped off of barbed wire. Is there any other, you know, things you wish could have been added to it?
I really don't know what would have been able to be added to it if nothing else. Maybe the final bump exploding, that might have been cool, but I don't even know how we would have pulled that off. No, I never really thought about it. I thought it was perfect the way it was, to tell you the truth.
Was that the highest thing you've ever taken at that point?
No. I got in a bad habit of jumping off balconies and putting guys through tables and stuff. And we was in, I can't even remember, we was in Illinois. And I was wrestling a guy called Manslaughter, and Manslaughter was about 350, 400 pounds, so, you know, he was just a big tampon to land on. Well, when we got there, they pointed at this balcony and said, can you jump off that balcony? I said, yeah, sure, no problem. So when the time came, I put him on the, I put Manslaughter on the table, and I started climbing the steps, and I was halfway up, and I'm tired. And I'm looking, and I got a hell of a lot more steps. I was like, oh, man. So then when I got to the edge of the balcony, I'm looking down, and, you know, it's a lot farther than what I thought it was, and it was either flip everybody off and turn heel and turn around and climb back down or die. But like I said, Manslaughter was a big old boy, so I just took the leap, and the table came up and hit him in the back of the head and knocked him out. But when I stood up, I was fine. So there was a janitor after the show who had one of those. It was a tape measure, but it's made of cloth. But you know, it's great big, and you got to roll it up with this handle thing. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
He held it over the edge, you know, so we could see how far that was, and it was 21, I think, 21 high.
Jeez.
So I thought I was doing something real good, and then the very next week, Two Touch Tony does the same thing, but jumps up in the air real high and makes a 21 into a 23, 24. But, yeah, that was probably the highest. That's not probably. That's the highest that I ever jumped. But I wouldn't have if I would have. If somebody would have told me, hey, that's 21 high, I wouldn't have done it. But me just glancing over and said, yeah, I can do that. And then climbing up those steps and looking down how small Manslaughter was, it was pretty stupid. The problem is I can't find a video of that. So it's like, did the tree make a noise in the forest, you know?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, man. And no one ran a tape on that beforehand, but like you said, you probably wouldn't have done it if you saw the numbers.
Right. Mike Bonomo is who ran that show, I believe, and I think he has a videotape of it. But I've never seen it.
Yeah, that's crazy. So, you know, we had talked about some of the, you know, matches with JC. You know, JC passing away, I mean, what was your memories of JC, you know, your fondest memories of JC?
Well, we all know that JC had his demons, and
sure,
we all overlooked them. But JC's dad called me and asked me, would I help JC? That, you know, he said he's really going down and he's really concerned for him. So the only thing I could think of is I know that JC wanted to go to Japan real bad.
Mm-hmm.
So I the numbers that I had for JC, you know, was no good. So I went to Evansville, Indiana, and I wasn't even on the card, but wound up wrestling JC that night. So after the match, I told JC, I said, look, I'll take you to Japan, but I can't have you over there all fucked up. You're going to have to, you know, sober up, and then I'll take you. Well, his love for going to Japan must have worked, because he didn't get all the way clean, but he got clean enough that, you know, he could take a plane trip. And a plane trip's 12 to 14 hours, depending on your wind current, over to Japan. And he stayed clean the whole tour while we was over there. And then as soon as we got back, he went right back off the wagon, you know. But
yeah.
I'm pretty proud of him, you know, that his demons were pretty strong, but he wanted to go to Japan. There's videotapes. You'll see, you know, his face is a lot more full, and you know, we was only over there about 3 weeks, but you know, you gotta give it up for JC. He cleaned up and really wanted to go to that. And then when he died, I really didn't believe until I showed up to the funeral, and sure enough. So you know, I was JC Bailey had a Superman tattoo on the back of his leg, and people would say, what are you, a Chris Hero Mark? And he'd say, fuck no, I'm a Madman Pondo Mark, because I have Superman tattooed on my arm. He would tell everybody that's the reason he got that on the back of his leg. I always thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, another one we lost, you know, I mentioned earlier, you know, you did a lot of travel in Japan and stuff, and it was Trent Acid. You any memories of Trent?
I sure do, man. Like, you know, Trent had every potential to make it in this business. You know, he never wanted to talk about his matches, but never missed a spot. You know, he was had a good body on him, good character and all that, but them demons kicked his ass, you know. I mean, if nothing in this world, I've been traveling with Crazy Mary, and, you know, I tell her, just leave these drugs alone, because, you know, Trent Acid is the, he just had it all going for him, and messed it all up for him, and, you know, I don't, you know, he was just such a good dude, always tried to make people laugh, always tried to make me laugh, but, you know, people are just going to have to leave them drugs alone.
Yeah. Yeah. Back in 2002, you had a match with Necro Butcher. It was light tubes, the whole nine. And his arm got, I mean, one of the worst injuries I've seen. Probably one of the worst he suffered over his career, too. What was your memories of that match?
I remember after I got done, how upset I was, you know, because the way that was supposed to go, the light tubes were supposed to go inside the ladder, you know, from ladder to ladder, tier to tier, but we just didn't have time to do that. So that's why we put that square in there, and sure enough, Necro's arm got trashed like that, and I felt so bad, and, you know, I was sitting up to myself, and Necro, with his arm all bandaged up, come over there, and he said, Pondo, what did you do when my arm got cut? And I said, what did you mean what I do? He says, what move did you give me? I said, a suplex off second rope. And he goes, okay, so where did your arm go? I said, my arm was underneath your neck. And he goes, where did my arm go? I said, underneath mine. He goes, so think about it. If my arm wasn't there, wouldn't that light tube have went through the back of your neck? And I was like, yeah. And he goes, my arm is fine. Your neck wouldn't have been. He told me to straighten up and act right. And after that moment, he was right. You know, I probably wouldn't be here today if it wasn't a suplex and that tube would have went through my neck. So, you know. But that's just Necro's attitude, you know. He doesn't want anybody to feel bad for anything.
You know, on a different note, you were on the Jerry Springer Show, I think more than once, too. How did that all come about? You know, what was it like going on that?
I had a buddy named Ace Craft that was getting the midgets. You know, he did a lot for the half-pint brawlers, midgets, and the micro midgets. Well, he was getting those booked on Jerry Springer a lot. And one day they called him and said, man, we need a character. We need get somebody who, you know, can talk. And Ace thought of me. So Jerry Springer called me on the phone, and the Jerry Springer Show called me on the phone and said, hey, can we get you to come out? I said, yeah, sure. You know, sounds like fun, you know. And I thought being on the Jerry Springer Show was going to be so much fun that I wouldn't worry about a paycheck. But then when I got a $300 paycheck, I was pretty happy about that. So I did the first show. Me, Too Tough Tony, and Mitch Page, we did the first one. And we, you know, we told each other, we was like, well, if they're going to know we're wrestlers, but let's go out there and let's really hit each other. So they cut our segment on TV, but we really was punching each other in the face. And, you know, I mean, we just thought, let's not be fake. Let's show the people of Jerry Springer what this was all about. Well, then they wouldn't let me, you know, because we did that. And Steve the bald-headed security guard, Steve, is a real cop. Well, he was supposed to arrest us after that. So, you know, so that you can't have real contact right in front of a cop. So they took us off the final question and answering. Tony got to be on there, but me and Mitch didn't. So I thought I was pretty well in trouble and done with the Jerry Springer Show, and I flew home. And a few days after that, they gave me a call and said, hey, do you know any interesting people? And I said, yeah. So I booked every guest for one episode. People, they got sent to another episode, but, you know, that there's four couples to an episode, and I booked them four couples. And they was really impressed with that, and they sent me a $800 check for that. And then they asked me if I would be willing to, you know, book more people. So there for a while, I was getting checks sent to me from the Jerry Springer Show. I even did another episode with another girlfriend that I had. You know, and they would fly me in. They flew me in like three times just to hang out with the guests that I got booked and stuff. So, but after a while, the Jerry Springer Show, if they call you, they want you to answer, and they expect you, you know, to drop what you're doing and find the people. So after a while, I was like, you know, fuck this and shit. So I told them I didn't want to do it anymore, and they still call me every once in a while, but, you know, it just became more of a headache work than anything. But I got to meet Ron Jeremy, which I met him a lot more now that he's part of the gatherings and stuff. I met Butterbean, you know, just cool people off that Jerry Springer thing. But it just wasn't for me, you know. I'm the type of guy that don't even want, you know, people to boss me around. But these guys, you know, you had like six bosses that would call you and ride you to the ground, and I told them I'm done with that. I don't want to do this no more.
Sure. So, you know, you talk about, you know, ICP and everything, and, you know, you did a lot, I think, touring with them and everything else. How'd you get into all that?
Me and Ian was wrestling in Detroit for a guy named Malcolm Monroe. There's another Malcolm Monroe Jr. wrestling there now, doing really good things. But this was his father's promotion, Malcolm Monroe. And one time, me and Ian with Sabu in the crowd did a thumbtack death match, and there was these two guys also on the show that, you know, they had dreadlocks and, you know, tattooed up everywhere. And after me and Ian got done wrestling, they came over and said, "Man, that shit was great. We loved every bit of that, you know." And they wrestled as Hector Hatchett and the Sewer Dweller. Well, they, you know, gave me a CD and some T-shirts and stuff like that. Well, I got to listen to the CD on my way home, and that was really good stuff. You know, I really dug that. And then there was some kids walking around the mall that had their T-shirts on in St. Louis, Missouri. So I was like, shit, I need to get a hold of those guys. Well, then they did a show called Stranglemania Live, and they got a hold of a guy named Dan Curtis, who got a hold of Ian, me, and we got another guy booked, and you know, it just went from there. I've been on all their wrestling shows, Stranglemania Live, Hellfire, and now JCW, and since until the gathering, me and Crazy Mary was their JCW Tag Team Champions. The Riders are now, but tomorrow is Hall of Wicked, and me and Mary are both wrestling on that in Detroit.
There's a lot of crazy stuff that goes on in the gathering. I mean, the stories you hear out of there, it's crazy stuff. Do you have any stories that have come out of, you know, working over there?
I will tell you that, you know, I have been to every one of them. 16 of them, which is, you know, unheard of. But out of 16 gatherings, there has been, you know, you'd say 50,000 to almost 100,000 kids over the 16 years it's been to these things. I've only seen 5 fights out of that whole time. You know, the gathering of the Jugging Boat gets a bad rep, but those kids are all about family. And, you know, for those 5 fights, I've seen thousands of good deeds back and forth to these kids. So there's no reason for the Gathering of the Juggalos to have the bad reputation that it is. But, you know, when you get that many kids together with all their face paint and everything, you know, people's just going to, you know, you hate what you don't understand. And,
right.
You know, if those people came and saw how those guys acted, you know, they might change their tune about the Gathering of the Juggalos, but it's just not going to happen. And I realize that that's what society is today. But, you know, I've seen so many artists over the years. I got to see Old Dirty Bastard before he died.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm good friends with Vanilla Ice, you know, something that I never thought I would be. Just hung out with so many cool people. Gilbert Godfrey, hung out with him, and just for me, the Gathering of the Juggalos is something every year that it wouldn't matter what I was doing, I would drop what I was doing and go to the Gathering of the Juggalos.
You're talking about celebrities and stuff like that, and, you know, people you've been close with. I saw a video not too long ago you put up with you and Marilyn Manson putting Vicks Vapor Rub in your eyes and seeing who took longer to tear up. How did that come about?
Well, this is what I think, which unofficially this was, okay, so Billy Corgan, of the Smashing Pumpkins, me and him met each other and got to be good friends from Resistance Pro in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after the concert, everybody with a backstage pass had to stay back, but me, Crazy Mary, and our other friend, Shaq Daddy, they took us into the cafeteria and had us sit down. And here come, and we had Marty Bell from TNA with us and her boyfriend and another guy. So we're sitting at the table, and here comes Billy, which, you know, it's cool. Marty Bell knows Billy from TNA. I mean, Crazy Mary, and we're just having a talk about that time Billy Corgan looks over to me and goes, "Pondo, here comes the Emperor." And I look at the doorway, and it's Marilyn Manson. Marilyn Manson comes over to the table, and he's got a little thing of Vicks Rubs on his finger, and he's rolling it around in his hand. He goes, "Billy, I want to do a challenge with somebody. Which one of these guys should I choose?" And Billy said, "That guy right there." So I think Billy Corgan might have told Marilyn Manson there was a guy who loves pain as much as he did, and I think Marilyn Manson was just trying to check it out and see, you know. So that's how that Vicks Rub, you can go on YouTube right now, it's Marilyn Manson versus Madman Pondo, the Vicks Rub Challenge. And the whole thing's on there, but, you know, I'm here to tell you that sucked. That was some terrible, terrible shit. Like, I wanted to get that out of my eyes, but, you know, I wasn't going to let Marilyn Manson beat me, so I stuck it out. But, you know, on contact, our eyes were already watering real bad, but it had to be the one that it ran down their cheeks. And sure enough, it ran down Marilyn Manson's cheek, and victorious Madman Pondo over Marilyn Manson.
How do you even get that out of your eyes? I mean, I figure even flushing it, that seems like the type of stuff to be waterproof.
We didn't put it in our eyes. We put it in our tear ducts.
Okay.
But just a napkin. Just a napkin, took it out, but I couldn't even imagine if it got in my eyes, because it was killing me just being my tear ducts.
Yeah. So how did you get started with IWA East Coast? How did you get that all going?
I was living in Mexico, Missouri, and there just wasn't any wrestling going on there. And a buddy of mine, Woody Numbers, he would call me constantly and say, hey, I need you to move out here. I want to run wrestling shows down here. But, you know, I just wasn't into it. You know, I didn't know how to run my own company. And finally, Woody Numbers said, listen, my grandma has houses down here that she'll rent you one for $400 a month. Well, I couldn't pass that up. So we loaded up the car and moved to Charleston, West Virginia. And at least once a week, he would bring up this subject about, come on, let's start running our own wrestling company here. So finally I told him, I said, listen, how many companies are currently going on here in Charleston? And there were seven of them. And all seven of them was having trouble drawing 100 people. So I told him, I said, you know, it's got to be that you know, it's just too fluttered, you know, there's too much wrestling in this area. So finally I told him, I said, all right, this is what we'll do. We will go to all seven companies and we'll watch their show and I'll see if I can't do anything different. Well, after company three or four or five, I told Woody, I said, look, I know how to draw people in this area. And he's like, how's that? I said, run a good show. I mean, it was just shitty shows. It was terrible shows. Some of them had small children wrestling for them. Some of them, anyway. So we decided to do the first show, and I told Woody, I said, all right, so I want to bring in a headliner. Who should we bring? And they was going over all these names, and about that time they said, I would say we should bring in Abdullah the Butcher, but he no-showed three times in this area. I said, oh, my God, that's your answer right there. And he's like, why is that our answer? I said, Abdullah and me are really close. He's the one who got me in Japan. So I called Abdullah, and Abdullah said, yep, fire me out, and I'm there. So we put Abdullah the Butcher versus Necro Butcher, Battle of the Butchers. That was our main event. Then Ryuji Ito, Dosuke Sakimoto, and Yuki Lee, they was always wanting to come to America and hang out and go shopping and stuff like that. So yeah. I got a hold of them and I said, hey, how would you guys like to come and wrestle on my first show here in America? So there was a semi-main, me versus Ryuji Ito, and then Dosuke Sakimoto took on Ian Rotten. I put a ladies match on the show. So, first I booked Chris Hero. And Chris Hero, he brought Cesaro, but he was Castaldi then. And he was dating Allison Danger. Chris Hero was dating Allison Danger. So right. We had Cesaro versus Chris Hero. Then we had Dickie Knuckles taking on Allison Danger. Then I wanted to have a little WWE name on the show. So I called Zach Gowan, and Zach Gowan took on Nate Webb as Backyard Wrestling's character, El Drunko. And everybody loved the show. I mean, it was the talk of the town. And I said, okay, let's do a second one. So the second one, we brought in New Jack. And the third one, we brought in Raven. Then we brought in the Sandman. And, you know, we just kept bringing in these names, and next thing we knew, we was drawing 250 to 300 people a show. So IWA's Coast ran for about, let's see, about 4 years, and it was pretty successful, but then I moved here to Louisville, and shit just kind of died. So a guy named Fat Ton, Michael Tawney, he still runs IWA's Coast. I still run the locker room, but I don't own it anymore.
Right. How did you get going with the Masters of Pain tournament?
Of course, Woody Numbers, again, kept saying, you know, let's do a deathmatch tournament. And he wanted to do one the first and second year. I'm sorry. Yeah, anyway, I said, well, here's the first thing we got to do. Let's save some money so we can get the materials to do it. Because without the materials to do it, your deathmatch tournament's going to suck.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when we built that ungodly, heavy barbed wire cage that, you know, it didn't have to be that. When I said barbed wire cage, I just meant four pieces of wood with barbed wire right across it. But we built like a fortress, and it cost so much money. So, you know, Masters of Pain was I think we did four of them. And, you know, people today, when they put what's the best deathmatch tournament you see, I go to the results, and sometimes, you know, not all the time, I'm, of course, Tournament of Death and King of the Death are the main ones, but we always get eight or nine people saying Masters of Pain, you know, this year and stuff like that. So I guess we put an impact with those Masters of Pain on deathmatch wrestling.
Sure. Now, you know, 2015, I've seen more, you know, deathmatch tournaments popping up all over the place. It's crazy. What's your thoughts on that?
I am actually pretty happy about it because there for a while, death, you know, let's just lay it out on the line. Tournament of Death was in DJ Hyde's grandma and grandpa's backyard because buildings just didn't want death matches anymore, you know. The Hannibal Abdullah story got out, you know, with the Hep C, and, you know, it wasn't even death matches anymore that was killing death matches. It was diseases out there, and, you know, I really don't know that many death match workers that's got diseased off this stuff, but, you know, without a building, without an area, you don't have a show. And, you know, that was people's big fright back then, you know, and death matches started to die. So now that I know, you know, Nick Gage just ran his, and Milestone out of North Carolina, they ran one. Kevin Brandon's doing the Carnage Cup. I'm happy that death matches are staying alive. I just, you know, don't want somebody to get fucked up in the process and, you know, run death matches right back down into the dark ages. But, you know,
right.
You got to give it up for the brave guys. As long as the brave guys hang around. Right now, to me, the number one death match guy is Matt Tremont. That man is fearless, and he's out to show that death matches are entertaining. So, I'd say right now the number one deathmatch guy is Matt Tremont.
Yeah, and he's a great dude on top of it.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, you mentioned IWA Deep South, what Kevin Brandon's doing. And, you know, I've been talking to a bunch of guys on the show, and, you know, after last year you put out somewhat of a press release that more or less said, like, you know, barbed wire is not enough, light tubes aren't enough. If that's all you're willing to do, don't contact us for bookings. We're taking it to the next level and stuff. And some of the picture that they painted looked kind of dangerous. As you said, like, if someone goes a little too far, it could ruin it for everybody. What's your thoughts on, you know, what he's putting out there?
Okay, here is my answer to that. But this is the only one I can give you. I wanted a job at CZW, so I was willing to cut a man and get cut by scissors. Now, is it to the extreme that Kevin Brandon and other deathmatch wrestlers are doing? No, but it's the same premise. People want to be noticed for things, therefore, you got to keep coming up with you know, dangerous things to do. Evel Knievel shouldn't have done half the shit he did, but he did it because he wanted to get noticed. So for me to be able to say, I think somebody's going too far, I can't, because I was the guy going too far, you know,
right,
before the uproar of death matches and all that. You know, I was the guy doing all this stuff that was just unheard of, you know. Now there's more people doing them, which makes it easier on me, but, you know, I really, you know, I don't have an answer that would not make me seem like a hypocrite to tell you that anybody's going too far, because before I was the guy going too far.
Sure. back in 2005, you went into Chikara and you worked the Chikara tag tournament thing. I don't know what you call it. You
King
had
of Trios. It wasn't King of Trios. There was just two of us, but I don't remember what it was either.
But in the first round, you and Necro wrestled some ROH students, and it seemingly became the beginning of the feud that launched into Necro and Samoa Joe and everything else. What was your memory of the match?
I remember that the ROH kids went and did an interview on me and Necro. I didn't care about it. You know, I didn't even know what they said. But I watched it on video later, and they, you know, the one guy was talking about how me and Necro is a cancer and what we do is not wrestling. That stuff doesn't bother me. I don't care about it. But I do remember they coming to me, and Necro was standing behind me, and they said, okay, it's your guys' turn for, you know, to do a promo. And I stood up, and Necro put me back down in my chair and said, we'll do our promo out there, which I thought he meant we would get on the microphone and do a promo, but no, he was legit mad at these ROH kids. So that's how you got what you got out of the ROH kids. Then, you know, I bitched Necro out. I'm like, man, we made it to Chikara. You're beating up these kids. What the fuck's wrong with you? You know, chill the fuck out. Well, then we wrestled two guys, Men at Work, I think. And, you know, they was going over all this stuff. And finally I stopped them and I said, look, me and Necro don't do this stuff. Are you guys going to be able to walk us through it? And they said, yeah, you know, we do this all the time. Well, spot 1, 2, or 3, they forgot what they was doing. So it was either make the match look good or let them keep shitting up the place. So, you know, I started laying into them, and, you know, one of them got a broke nose. One of them, it wasn't the finish, but I made one of them submit, you know, just, and then Necro was like, oh, bitching me out, but you beat these guys, you know. So I thought they would never have us back at Chikara, but we was invited the next year. Mike Clackenbush said we was the most talked about thing on the tournament, but, you know, something was going on. I couldn't make it. I can't remember if Necro made it or not. That was about my memories of Chikara.
Yeah. You were able to get into the video game scene with Backyard Wrestling. What was your thoughts on actually, you know, seeing your face on a video game?
I was at the Gathering of the Juggalos, and this guy, pretty friendly, you know, sitting at the bar, and I'm not much of a drinker, but, you know, he was a good dude, so, you know, he would buy me drinks, and I kept telling him the last night, after I get paid, I'll buy the drinks. Well, that guy was Kevin Gill. And sure enough, he paid for the drinks, but then on the last night, he didn't think I was serious, but I went to him, and sure enough, I bought the drink. So I was already over with Kevin Gill, but he kept telling me, yeah, I'm here to put a bunch of, you know, put ICP and wrestlers in a video game. Man, in this wrestling, I've heard so much shit in my life. I didn't even care. You know, cool. If you can do it, cool. But if not, you know, I don't expect much. But sure enough, that's what happened. He put us in a video game, and then part two came out. You know, I was a part of that. And then Return to Fire Pro. You know how, have you ever played Fire Pro?
Yeah.
Okay, when you're a character in the game, your name is blue, but when you're a created character, your name is green. but I'm happy to say that my name is Blue and returned to Fire Pro.
Yeah, that's cool. So, you know, you and Tony had, you know, toured a bunch, you know, as far as being a tag team and everything else. They brought you in 2005 up against Nick Gage and Justice Payne in CZW. And at the time, I mean, they were pretty much just running through guys, and it seemed like that was the case with you guys, too. It didn't seem like nearly as competitive as I expected it to be. What do you remember about that match?
I remember it was just terrible. They had their ideas. Tony has his ideas, and me, I'm just trying to get along with everybody. And they didn't really like Tony. You know, Tony had a lot of ideas, and he kept trying to throw them out there. And me, I'm just trying to get this match going. It just, you know, we just didn't all four click good. And you know, I guess you saw the video. It just wasn't the best match on the card at all. And
yeah, I was there.
But I do remember it wasn't a very good match.
Yeah. Had you worked in the past with Justice Payne, or, you know, had that always been a problem with him, or was it just the match?
I used to work Justice Payne in Zandig, and then Zandig went over to the big Japan side, so you know, Justice Payne was on the CZW side, so I really didn't work him all that much, but I can almost picture that. I remember that I don't remember if I did or not. I get hit in the head too much, but I never had any problem with Justice Payne, so I don't know. Just that night, it was just not our night.
Sure. What was your favorite memories of Japan? Because you spent a lot of time in Japan and, you know, worked pretty much everyone.
I was there from 2000 till 2008. And, man, getting into wrestling, that was my dream. It was never WWE. It was never WCW. None of that. My dream was to get to Japan. And to this day, I've been 43 times there and back, so I pretty well lived that dream. And my biggest joy, my biggest proudest moment in Japan was when Masanaga came and gave me his wing bands for my wrists and told me to, had the translator tell me to start calling myself the American Danger Man. I mean, that was the guy that I was watching, you know, to get into these death matches. So that was a damn big moment for me.
Sure. Do you have any good road stories?
Good road
I'm
stories.
Sure you do.
yeah, just so many.
Sure.
The one that sticks to mind, we was on tour with ICP, actually JCW was, and one of the Juggalos loaned me his girlfriend for the night. And, you know, so all of a sudden I became pretty popular. Well, we got on the tour bus, and Mitch Page had already fell asleep. So I told this girl, I said, look, this is what I want you to do. I want you to reach in this. Because on the tour bus, we had these curtains that would shut. And, you know, that would be your little room inside these cubby holes. I told this girl, I want you to reach inside this curtain and jack this guy off like you never have before. So she licked her hands and she started jacking him off. Then I put my face inside the curtain. So when he woke up, that's what he saw. He saw me and damn near killed the girl. You know, that was a pretty good road story.
Shit. Crazy. Is there anything in death matches that you wish you never did or wouldn't do again?
Those pencils, man. That was That was the worst shit ever. I'm telling you. Okay, so I drove to where was it at? That was in Delaware, that one?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So I drove to Delaware, and I had a Asian wife at the time who didn't have a driver's license, and Gypsy Joe in the back seat who didn't drive. So after those pencils, like I told you, my whole body was just agonizing, you know, just fucking kicking me in the ass. But I'm the one that had to drive home, had to drive all the way from Philly to Charleston, West Virginia. Then we had tickets the next day for in Cleveland, Ohio, for the Indians versus the Yankees, and we'd had these tickets for a while. So then I drove from the next day, Charleston, to Cleveland, 4 hours, sat in those comfortable baseball seats, then got back in the car, drove home. You know, it was just terrible. And then finally on the sixth day, I could click my fingernail on the piece of lead that was stuck inside my ass. So I just put my fingers on both sides of it, got me a razor, made the hole a little bit bigger, pushed, and it came out. And for a long time, I still had that piece in a plastic bag. I have no idea where it is now. But, yeah, I would say those pencils was the worst, dumbest idea I ever had.
Damn. Yeah, that's some pretty extreme stuff, man. So, you know, as of recently, I think, you know, traveling with Mary and everything, you wound up being a rosebud. What was that situation like?
I dropped Crazy Mary off at the arena, and then I went back to the hotel, and I wasn't there 10, 15 minutes, and I get a phone call from some number that I didn't know, but I answered it, and it was John Cone, the referee at WWE. He said, "Are you still in Memphis?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm at the hotel." And he said, "Is there any way you can come back?" And the reason, do you watch WWE at all?
Yeah.
Okay, do you remember when a bunch of security guards pushed Dean Ambrose in a door, and then they stood outside blocking the door? Well, anyway,
that's what
happened. And so they lost a bunch of their rosebuds to catch Adam Rose because he does that fall from the second rope.
Right.
So they needed guys. So I told – and one thing I know about, you know, being backstage there, you have to dress up because I've watched Crazy Mary dress up. Everybody's dressed up. And I told him, I said, I don't have any dress clothes. I mean, I was in a Texas Chainsaw Massacre T-shirt. And they said, we don't care what you're wearing. We just need you to come back. And so I came back, and I was the one in the back that caught Adam Rose. Two for his legs, two for his arms, one for his middle, and then I was the neck. So, you know, when I showed up, all the extras are looking at me like, who's this motherfucker that don't have to dress up, you know? So nobody was really paying that much attention to me and didn't talk to me much. So we're sitting backstage, and we're waiting on Adam Rose and the Bunny to do their promo, and somebody comes over and puts me in a headlock and starts giving me work shots, and they finally let me go, and I look, and it's Dean Ambrose.
Yeah.
So, you know, he sits there and talks to me for about 10 minutes, and then when he leaves, next thing I know, all the extras want to start talking to me, you know, and I wasn't having them. I'm like, bunch of fake fuckers, you know.
Right.
So that was how I got to be a rosebud. And then in Cincinnati, Ohio, for a house show, I got to be a rosebud. So I got never thought I'd work for WWE, but I got two checks out of them, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, man. If you had to pick three matches out of your career that you'd put like on a highlight reel or whatever the case is, that would be your favorite. What would those three matches be?
Number one would be Terry Funk when I run the JCW, when I won the JCW title off of him at the Gathering of the Juggalos. Number two would be the Toby Klein match with the pencils. And number three would be me and Too Tough Tony versus Abdullah Kobayashi and Kenzo Suzuki. And I'll explain to you why. They put me and Tony versus Kenzo Suzuki just got just quit or got fired from WWE. So it was his first match back from Japan. So they put me and Tony versus him thinking that they would boo us and cheer for them. But nothing was farther from the truth. You know, when me and Tony walked out, they was chanting Baka Gaijin, and they didn't give two shits whether Kenzo Suzuki was there or not. So that was a pretty good moment in my life.
Nice. Yeah, I think that's about all I got, man. If there's anything else you want to put out there, plug.
It's very strange, but here lately, I haven't been doing all that many matches or anything like that, but I have started my own all-girls wrestling company called Girl Fight.
Okay.
It's been getting pretty popular. You can search Girl Fight Wrestling on Facebook, and you'll see the page. You know, we've had Jessica Havoc, Blue Pants, of course, Crazy Mary Dobson, Taylor Hendricks, Candice LeRae. You know, we've got some pretty good matches under our belts, and the reason I'm doing it is I want to, you know, help ladies wrestling, because I think ladies wrestling's got a pretty bad rap, because, you know, guys will just put two girls in the ring and call it ladies wrestling, but,
right,
you know, sometimes not be the best match in the world, but, you know, we put them together where there's good ladies matches, and that's Girl Fight Wrestling on, you know, you can check it out on Facebook.
Now, you know, with the women's wrestling, you know, some of it, like you said, does get a bad stigma. You know, you do have, I guess, a group of the female wrestling audience, I should say, I guess. They kind of use it more so as a fetish than a sport.
Right.
You know, how do you deal with that and, you know, cater towards the wrestling side of things? Or do you have to embrace that to a certain extent?
No, we don't have to embrace it at all. I tell all the girls it's not a TNA show to go out there and wrestle just like you would, you know,
right,
like the guys would. I was sitting in the arena, Full Sail, in Orlando for Sasha Banks versus Bayley.
So yeah,
excellent
match
from beginning to end. You know, the crowd was going nuts. And that was a 30-minute match, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was legit 30 minutes because they had it on the time thing, you know, the timer. And I figure if those two at NXT can have a women's match like that, that I don't understand where women's wrestling – well, I do understand where women's wrestling is getting a bad rep. I mean, some women out there just shouldn't be wrestlers. You know, I'll just
right.
lay it out there online. There's some that's been doing this for a while who has been nowhere. You know, I mean, why? Why would you think that? So I just get a good group of girls together and we just have a good time. You know, that's one of the main rules on my shows is that everybody has a good time. And you know, so far that's what's happened. And you know, I've been traveling with Crazy Mary, shows that she goes to, and, you know, just watching her. And it's actually helped me rejuvenate my body a little bit. And, you know, I've been enjoying I never thought I'd be a fan of women's wrestling like I am, but, you know, here I am today running my own women's show, so.
Sure. And is that a difficult thing to keep it, you know, to the way it is supposed to be, you know, wrestling-based and wrestling-focused? Is it hard to, you know, battle against that thing?
I've only had one instance where one guy was chanting, "Show me your tits." I went over and, you know, calmed him down and said, "That's not what this show's about." And, you know,
right.
that was just one instance out of six shows that we ran. So, nah, it's not that hard, really.
Good. Oh, excellent. Yeah. Is there anything else you got? Anything other? Any other plugs?
You can find me at Kevin Canady, C-A-N-A-D-Y on Facebook. I guess that's about all I got.
All right, man. Yeah, thanks for coming on. I really, really appreciate it. Definitely like to have you back on in the future, too, man. It's been a lot of fun.
Sounds great. Get you some more questions together, and here I am.
All right, man. Sounds good.
All right. Thank you for your time.
All right, no problem, man. Have a good night.
All right, buddy. Bye.
So there you go, man. It's Madman Pondo. And I hope everybody enjoyed that. But in like an hour and a half just now. So I think that's very good. I enjoyed it very much. And there you go. I'll talk to you guys on Wednesday. My guest will be JT Dunn.
We're all a bunch of fucking assholes. You know why? You don't have the guts to be what you want to be. You need people like me. You need people like me so you can point your fucking fingers and say, that's the bad guy. So, what I make you? Good? You're not good. You just know how to hide. How to lie. Me, I don't have that part. Me, I always tell a truth. Even when I lie. So say goodnight to the bad guy.
I'm gonna tell you something straight off the motherfucking press. I ain't coming for no fools.